I'm John Moe. This is Future Tense from American Public Media. The other day, we were reading about this report by a research company called Generator. It says financial transactions done through mobile phones are about to explode. By 2014, we'll be moving $633 billion a year through that little thing in our pocket. Kind of amazing. Unless you've spent time in Africa.
Well, this is one of these amazing places where Africa's ahead of the rest of the world.
That's Ethan Zuckerman. He's a researcher at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. He closely follows technology in Africa. I asked him how cell phones are being used there.
Mobile phones have been used as a payment device across the African continent for a few years now. And one of the reasons it's caught on so quickly is that there's no other infrastructure to replace it. In sub-Saharan Africa, credit cards are not very widespread. Most people don't have them. Bank checks are fairly uncommon. And so what this means is that if you want to make a major purchase, you're often carrying shopping bags full of cash. And you can imagine how inconvenient this gets.
I imagine that's dangerous, walking around with huge bags full of cash.
I'm sort of a big guy and fairly intimidating looking, and I used to have the job of being bagman for my friends in Ghana who wanted to buy cars.
Oh, no.
And literally, buying a used car required two huge shopping bags full of cash. Now this is all on your phone.
What's going out over these phones? Is it currency? Is it minutes on the phone? What is moving around?
I think Uganda may have been the first country to really adopt this. And they had a system called Sente. And what happened with Sente is you basically just sent information. So you were in Kampala. You bought a phone card on the MTN network. And let's say you bought it for the equivalent of $20. You would call up the phone lady in your home village, and you would read her the code on the back of your card. She would use that to top up her phone, and so she functionally had just been transferred $20. And then you would say, okay, give $19.50 to my mother. Oh, and by the way, put her on the phone so that I can make sure that she says, yes, I got the money. What happened was a number of people in the development community realized that this was a really powerful technology. It was really useful, and they formalized the system in Kenya under a system called M-Pesa. And in M-Pesa, you're no longer really transferring minutes anymore. You're just at this point transferring money. And so if you have an M-Pesa-enabled mobile phone, it simply has another menu which says, do you want to send money and who do you want to send it to?
How widespread is this across different nations in Africa, and what is that doing to the economies there?
Well, mostly what it's doing to the economies is it makes them more efficient. It's unevenly spread across the continent. Kenya, Uganda have been particularly good. I think Nigeria is making some moves in this space. Zambia has been a real pioneer. There's incredibly rapid consumer adoption. And my sense is that what you see happening in Africa is a really interesting precursor for the rest of the world.
How so?
The way in which we have easy access to credit and easy access to cash alternatives is pretty uncommon in the rest of the world. And if you think about just how many people in sub-Saharan Africa, in India, in China, who might experience banking for the first time through the mobile phone rather than through the ATM card or through the bank line, I think what we're really looking at is a global movement of billions of people coming into more formal economic and banking systems.
As the world seems to be rapidly expanding in mobile phone payments, what can new companies learn from all that has already evolved in Africa?
We tend to assume that innovative services get picked up by early adopters. So alpha geeks who are out there Twittering and foursquaring and using whatever's newest. It may turn out that payment technology is the sort of thing that gets adopted by marginal groups before it gets adopted by early adopters, because marginal groups have more use for it. If you have, you know, three or four functioning credit cards, you may not be all that excited about paying with your mobile phone. But if you are unbanked in one fashion or another, this may actually be very exciting and very innovative. So understanding that not only is there opportunity at the bottom of the pyramid, but there's innovation at the bottom of the pyramid is something that technology companies should be taking seriously.
So it's a way of transferring money around. Obviously, a mobile phone is a way of talking to other people, of having communications open. What are some other ways that this mobile phone economy is being used in Africa?
Well, one of the really intriguing stories that's going on right now, and I don't know how well this is going to work, but it's a very interesting idea. Niger tends to suffer from famines almost every year, and it's a function of regional food shortage. If the country had better infrastructure, they could move food from one area to another. Instead, what happens is that it's not that food is non-existent, it just gets too expensive for people to buy in some part of the country. And so you may be able to address famine by simply giving your poorest people a bit more money so they can buy millet at market at higher prices. And so the government of Niger right now is trying to address an impending famine by targeting poor women and sending credits to them on their mobile phones. They can then go to local phone vendors and turn them in for cash and get that for millet for their families. So it sounds totally crazy, and the notion that starving people have mobile phones is really unfamiliar to a lot of us, but starving people have mobile phones, and this is a really innovative way to try to use what infrastructures you have in place in Niger to try to address famine.
How is it that starving people in Africa do have mobile phones? I mean, I pay a monthly mobile phone bill in America that's pretty sizable. I can't understand how people who can't afford food can have one of those.
Well, it turns out that this is another place where Africa may well be ahead of where we are in the United States. Africa, in many cases, actually has competitive telecoms. Our version of competition wouldn't fly in most African nations, where there are two or three firms that price very, very similarly to one another. In Ghana, where I spend a lot of time, there are six or seven mobile phone firms in a country that's much, much smaller than the United States. And they are trying very, very hard to compete both on features as well as on price. And what that means is at the very low end of the Ghanaian market, there are analog mobile phones. So old school AMPS phones that you can pick up for about $5 each, and you can buy $2 or $3 worth of credit. And it turns out that that is within reach of many, many people in society, down to some of the poorest. And then at the top end of that market, there are 3G mobile phones that have better data service than I get here in Williamstown, Massachusetts.
How quickly did this whole market in Africa rise up? I mean, how far back does this go?
Well, I mean, I can tell you that when I first lived in Africa in 93 and 94, no one made phone calls. Ever. You know, to make a phone call, I had to go 7 kilometers to the nearest phone center from where I was living, and I was living in the capital city. Now, at this point, my middle-class African friends usually carry 2 or 3 cell phones because they often carry them for different networks. I would say that the transformation has taken less than 10 years and has been just thorough and profound, from going from literally no telecommunications at all to an expectation that everybody you know either has a cell phone or can get their hands on one in almost no time if they need it.
So where is it going from here?
It's the infrastructure that we will use to build other infrastructures. So what we're talking about here is how you build a banking system on top of mobile phones. But you should also in the long term be able to build transport systems on top of it. Rather than waiting for the taxi or the bus to come by, you should be able to send a message and say, I have a load of fruit that I want to bring to the market, and I'm willing to negotiate with someone who's willing to come pick it up for me. That turns out to be a very powerful way to do informal transport systems. Over time, you're going to find a way that people use mobile phones as payment devices to pay for toll roads, and toll roads are going to be a way that we end up building a lot of the basic transport infrastructure. It's possible that as payment infrastructure becomes more widespread, you can use it to do payments for things like electricity and water. So it's an infrastructure that lets us build infrastructures, and those are the most exciting tools that we have.
It's almost like a more versatile version of the internet that we in the States are used to.
Well, so here's the caution. It is less open than the internet. We are celebrating the mobile phone not because it is the best technology. We're celebrating the mobile phone because it's a very pervasive technology. And it's very pervasive because commercial companies have figured out how to build networks cost-effectively in very, very poor places. If there's a problem with the mobile phone network, and there is, It's that the operators have a great deal of control over what applications run on top of it, and they potentially have a great deal of control over the content that runs on top of it. I think it's generally a bad idea to run an anti-government movement on top of mobile phones because they're easily monitored. And if you could imagine someone coming up with a truly innovative new financial transfer system that challenged, say, M-Pesa in Kenya, it's possible that Safaricom would basically say, we're not going to authorize that on our system. So we should be thrilled about it. We should celebrate it. We should leverage it as much as we can. But we should realize that actually it's not the Internet. It's nowhere near as open and as generative as the Internet. And that's a real caution and concern we have to have about it in the long term.
Ethan Zuckerman is a researcher with Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Ethan, thanks.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Future Tense is produced by Larissa Anderson. I'm John Moe.
American Public Media.